company Ranbaxy, and as such, ineffective in combating the disease. Bill Clinton's desire to cure AIDS, HIV in Kazakhstan was an obvious pretext when we appreciate that Kazakhstan, the Central Asian country that was once part of the former Soviet Union, possesses some 12% of the world's uranium resources. With Kazakhstan's expanding mining capabilities, the country became the leading uranium producer in 2009, accounting for 28% of world uranium production, a percentage that has grown to 39% in 2015-16. Meanwhile, Giustra wanted to see if he could talk his way into an ownership interest in several uranium mines. Giustra got Kazakhstan's ruling despot at the time, Nursultan Nazarbayev, identified as a torturer and human rights violator, to approve the coveted uranium deal for Eurasia, even though Eurasia was a startup company with virtually no experience in the highly competitive uranium business. Mukhtar Dzhakashev, president of Kazatomprom, the government agency that runs Kazakhstan's uranium mines and nuclear energy industry, has subsequently revealed that then-Senator Hillary Clinton pressured Kazakh officials to cede the uranium rights to Giustra that he requested. The New York Times reported that once the 2005 uranium agreement with Kazakhstan was final, the next year Giustra donated $31.3 million to the Clinton Foundation to help fight HIV/AIDS in Africa as a payoff, a gift that remained secret until 1 month before the Times published its expose in 2008. The gift, combined with Mr. Giustra's more recent and public pledge to give the William J. Clinton Foundation an additional $100 million, secured Mr. Giustra a place in Mr. Clinton's inner circle, an exclusive club of wealthy entrepreneurs in which friendship with the former president has its privileges, reporters noted. All this suggests that Bill Clinton and Frank Giustra arriving in Kazakhstan on the same day in 2005 was not coincidental. Russia deploys spies to the United States to bribe Clintons. Andrew C. McCarthy, the columnist for the National Review who previously served as an assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, has argued that Russia was outraged that Kazakhstan, formerly a part of the Soviet Union, had allowed Bill Clinton and Frank Giustra to walk off with the lucrative uranium contract. In May 2009, Russia arrested Dzhakashev, president of Kazatomprom, and charged him with stealing uranium assets and embezzling shares in uranium mines, as well as money laundering and bribe-taking. In March 2010, Dzhakashev was convicted to 14 years in a maximum security prison. The Financial Times in London noted that under Dzhakashev's leadership, Kazatomprom was transformed from a bankrupt Soviet mining behemoth into a global nuclear power company with partners in North America, Europe, Japan, China, and Russia. But Dzhakashev's mistake was allowing Clinton and Giustra to grab Kazakh uranium mines that Putin coveted. Putin ultimately resolved that his best approach to solve the problem was to have the Russian government-controlled energy company Rosatom acquire Uranium One, thereby recapturing the interests in Kazakhstan uranium mines that Uranium One had managed to acquire. To implement this plan, Putin decided to launch an espionage operation in the United States, with the goal of bribing the Clintons to allow Rosatom to acquire Uranium One. To implement his scheme, Putin used Kremlin-controlled trucking company Tenex, a subsidiary of Rosatom. In 1992, President George H.W. Bush had allowed Tenex to operate in the United States to transfer uranium purchased from Russia's dissembled nuclear warheads to the United States after the uranium had been downblended from its highly enriched weapons-grade level. Tenex operated in the United States through Tenem USA, a company operating in Bethesda, Maryland, that was run by Vladim Mikurin, a Russian official from Rosatom. In arranging contracts with Tenem Rosatom with U.S. companies purchasing Russian uranium, Mikurin engaged in a scheme of defrauding the U.S. contractors into paying inflated prices for uranium, with the excess proceeds laundered through shell companies and secret bank accounts in Latvia, Cyprus, Switzerland, and the Seychelles Islands. The inflated payments served two purposes. They enriched Kremlin-connected energy officials in the U.S. and in Russia, to the tune of millions of dollars, and they compromised the American companies that paid the bribes, rendering players in U.S. nuclear energy, a sector critical to national security, vulnerable to blackmail by Moscow, former prosecutor Andrew McCarthy noted. In 2009, to further Putin's scheme of acquiring Uranium One, Mikurin hired as a lobbyist or consultant an associate connected to Russian organized crime groups who was to implement the strategy of Uranium One, bribing its way to an increasing control of the U.S. uranium market. Uncomfortable that Mikurin's extortion scheme that involved Russian suitcases stuffed with $100 bills was criminal, the lobbyist went to the FBI to expose the wrongdoing. Rather than prosecute the lobbyist, the FBI recruited the lobbyist to participate in the Russian racketeering scheme as a confidential source, identified only as CS1 in government affidavits. FBI investigation into the Tenem-Rosatom extortion and bribery scheme was based out of Maryland, where then-FBI Director Robert Mueller put the investigation under the control of Rod J. Rosenstein, then U.S. Attorney in Maryland. Recall that when Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Russian collusion investigation, Rosenstein, acting as Deputy Attorney General, appointed his former boss, Robert Mueller, to serve as the special counselor investigating Trump. With the assistance of CS1, the FBI made secret recordings and intercepted emails as early as 2009 that showed the Moscow-compromised uranium trucking company Tenem engaged in a racketeering scheme of bribes and kickbacks in violation of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. This was occurring while Russian nuclear officials routed millions of dollars to the United States to benefit the Clinton Foundation, and while Secretary Clinton served on the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS. CFIUS is the interagency committee operating out of the Treasury that would have to vote to give Rosatom permission to acquire ownership interests in Uranium One. Note that CFIUS voted twice, first in 2010 and finally in 2013, to approve Rosatom's acquisition of Uranium One, without being told that the FBI had been investigating the Russians since 2009 for operating a spy network through Tenem USA, with the goal of bribing their way into getting CFIUS approval for Rosatom to acquire Uranium One. The Russians were compromising American contractors in the nuclear industry with kickbacks and extortion threats, all of which raised legitimate security concerns, noted investigative reporters John Solomon and Allison Spann, quoting an informant in an article published by The Hill on October 17, 2017. The article that first broke the news the Obama FBI had suppressed the Russian spy bribery racketeering scheme. The involvement of Rosenstein and Mueller in suppressing the Russian bribery scheme should be sufficient evidence to disqualify both from investigating President Trump. Clearly, Rosenstein and Mueller understood that CFIUS would never have granted permission for Rosatom to buy Uranium One if the Russian bribery scheme had been fully disclosed to the public in 2010. If the DOJ opens an investigation into the Uranium One case, Mueller will almost certainly find himself the subject of hard scrutiny. As a target of a DOJ criminal investigation, the pressure on Mueller to step down as special counselor in the Russian collusion investigation targeting the Trump campaign will be intense. This case highlights yet again the degree to which Mueller and Rosenstein function within the federal justice system as deep state operatives. The Uranium One case should be added to the long list of cases in which Mueller, Comey, Holder, and Lynch have conspired to end investigations that could well have produced criminal charges against Bill and Hillary Clinton, as well as Barack Obama. The corruption of the FBI and DOJ clearly impacted the 2016 elections, as "drain the swamp" and "lock her up" were chanted by Trump supporters at virtually every campaign rally Trump held on his way to being elected president. Russia takes control of Uranium One. A State Department memorandum dated June 28, 2009, released by WikiLeaks, documented that on June 15, 2009, Uranium One bought a 50% stake in a high-value Kazakhstan uranium holding company, of which Kazakhstan's state nuclear company, Kazatomprom, owned the other 50%. In October 2010, Cepheus voted to allow Rosatom to acquire majority control, 51%, of Uranium One. At that time, Secretary Clinton and Attorney Eric Holder were members of the committee, with Obama administration Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner serving as chairman. Although Hillary Clinton denies that she was personally involved and did not vote, records show that Hillary was in close contact with Jose Fernandez, the person who cast the proxy vote for Hillary as the State Department representative on Cepheus when the Rosatom vote was taken. Fernandez pledged his loyalty to Clinton in return for an assurance from John Podesta that he would receive a position on the board of Podesta's Leftist Center for American Progress. In 2013, through its subsidiary Arms Uranium Holding, Russian state-owned Rosatom acquired 100% of Uranium One in a transaction valued at $1.3 billion. That same year, Cepheus voted a second time to approve the deal, giving official U.S. government blessing to the Russians owning Uranium One, a transaction that allowed the Russian government to control one-fifth of all uranium production capacity in the United States. According to a New York Times article, between 2008 and 2010, Uranium One and Eurasia investors gave $8.66 million in donations to the Clinton Foundation. By the time the Russians had acquired 100% of Uranium One in 2013, nine of the shareholders in the company had reportedly contributed $145 million in donations to the foundation. Throughout the 2010 through 2013 period, FBI Director Robert Mueller, who served as the head of the FBI from September 4, 2001 to September 4, 2013, did nothing to investigate the complex payments to the Clinton Foundation that give the appearance of a pay-to-play arrangement with Frank Giustra that allowed the Clintons to reap millions of dollars, provided Secretary of State Hillary Clinton did her part to guarantee Cepheus approval of the Uranium One deal with Putin's Rosatom. A linchpin of the Clinton argument that the Uranium One deal had been investigated multiple times and there was nothing new to find was that Uranium One had been prohibited by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, NRC, from shipping any U.S. uranium overseas. On November 2, 2017, investigative reporters John Solomon and Allison Spann printed a story in The Hill revealing that NRC memos received by the publication show that the commission did approve the shipment of yellowcake uranium, the uranium used to make nuclear fuel and weapons, from the Russian-owned mines in the United States to Canada in 2012 through a third party. Subsequently, the Obama administration approved some of that uranium to be shipped to Europe. While the NRC insisted that these overseas shipments only lasted from 2012 to 2014, it is clear the commission authorized an amendment to an existing export license for a Kentucky-based trucking firm called RSB Logistics Services Incorporated to add Uranium One to the list of clients whose uranium it could move to Canada. The investigative reporters noted that these arrangements were hidden from Congress, leaving open the question of whether the Russian bribery scheme could have created other third-party shipment arrangements that would have circumvented the NRC's reassurance that the Uranium One deal could not possibly result in a shipment of U.S. yellowcake uranium ending up in the hands of the Russians. So by getting Cepheus to allow Rosatom to acquire 100% of Uranium One in 2013, Putin achieved his goal of not only recapturing the Kazakhstan uranium rights that Bill Clinton and Frank Giustra had obtained in 2009, but also obtaining the right to transport Uranium One production overseas. 15 months before the 13 members of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, known as Cepheus, approved the sale of the Canadian company Uranium One to Russia's nuclear arms giant Rosatom, the FBI began investigating persons who were connected to the Russian state corporation, investigative journalist Sarah A. Carter wrote. Carter noted that the FBI said in court and in interviews that by 2010, they had gathered enough evidence to prove that Rosatom-connected officials were engaged in a global bribery scheme that included kickbacks and money laundering. FBI officials said the investigation could have prevented the sale of Uranium One, which controlled 20% of U.S. uranium supply under U.S. law, Carter stressed. Mueller delivers uranium to Russia on a secret mission for Hillary. On May 17, 2017, the day Deputy Attorney General Rod J. Rosenstein appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel, Julian Assange tweeted a reference to a WikiLeaks released State Department cable that documented Secretary of State Hillary Clinton ordering Mueller to deliver a sample of stolen, highly enriched uranium, HEU, to Russia in 2009. The WikiLeaks tweet referenced a Secretary of State Clinton communique sent to John Beryl, U.S. Ambassador in Russia, and the U.S. Ambassador to the Embassy in Tbilisi, Georgia, and the Russian Embassy, dated August 17, 2009, indicating that FBI Director Mueller was planning to fly to Moscow on September 21, 2009, to deliver a sample of highly enriched uranium, HEU, that the cable identified had been confiscated by the U.S. Department of Energy during a 2006 nuclear smuggling sting operation involving one Russian national and several Georgian accomplices. The key operational language of the cable was contained in paragraph 6. S. Rel. Russia. Action request. Embassy Moscow is requested to alert at the highest appropriate level the Russian Federation that FBI Director Mueller plans to deliver the HEU sample once he arrives to Moscow on September 21st. Post is requested to convey information in paragraph 5 with regard to chain of custody and to request details on Russian Federation's plan for picking up the material. Embassy is also requested to reconfirm the April 16 understanding from the FSB verbally that we will have no problem with the Russian Ministry of Aviation concerning Mueller's September 21st flight clearance. On June 19, 2017, Shepard Embellis, the editor-in-chief of IntelliHub.com, noted that the classified State Department cable in question that proposed Director Mueller should be the one to personally conduct the transfer of a 10-gram sample of HEU to Russian law enforcement sources during a secret plane-side meeting on a tarmac in early fall of 2009 was reminiscent of the infamous Loretta Lynch-Bill Clinton meeting, which occurred on a Phoenix, Arizona tarmac back in June of 2016. Exactly why Secretary Clinton decided it was critical to arrange a clandestine transfer of this purloined uranium sample back to Russia, carried out by Director Mueller in a secret trip to Moscow, has never been made clear. However, several WikiLeaks cables show that the State Department had been tracking Uranium-1 dealings with Kazakhstan since 2008. While Clinton apologists have insisted that Mueller's secret mission to Russia has no connection to Uranium-1 or Secretary Clinton's role in the CFIUS votes that allowed Putin to control 20% of U.S. uranium, the issue demands detailed investigation, especially because there is abundant evidence that Mueller turned a blind eye to numerous highly suspicious, potentially criminal Uranium-1 transactions related to Frank Giustra. On January 26, 2007, the Associated Press reported that Igor Shkabura, deputy director of the Bochvar Inorganic Materials Unit, said the sample of uranium seized in the sting operation was weapons grade, but the sample was too small to determine its origin, according to reports published by Russian news agencies RIA Novosti and Itar Tass. Given that Russia already had samples of the HEU stolen in 2006, what value was there to the very small 10-gram amount the United States possessed that would justify Director Mueller personally conducting a clandestine mission to make a tarmac drop of the U.S. sample in Moscow? Exactly why Secretary of State Hillary Clinton ordered FBI Director Robert Mueller to make a secret trip to Russia remains shrouded in mystery. Podesta Group, D.C. lobbyist for Russian bank, accused in Ukraine of terrorist ties. While the mainstream media continues to obsess over Paul Manafort and General Michael Flynn's supposed Russian collusion, totally ignored are the ties Tony Podesta, the brother of Hillary's 2016 presidential campaign chairman John Podesta, had to both Uranium One and Sberbank, Moscow's largest state-run bank, which has close ties to international terrorism and Russian President Vladimir Putin. As the Russians gained control of Uranium One from 2009 through 2013, the Podesta Group was paid a total of $630,000 between 2010 and 2015 to represent Uranium One the Russian-controlled firm with close financial ties to the Clinton Foundation that today controls 20% of all U.S. uranium produced. Among the revelations made public through the 11.5 million documents leaked by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, detailing the legal and financial arrangements behind secretive offshore banking transactions dating back to the 1970s, was the disclosure that Sberbank uses the Podesta Group as its registered lobbyist in Washington. Sberbank, savings bank in Russian, engaged the Podesta Group to help its public image, leading Moscow financial institutions not exactly being known for their propriety and wholesomeness, and specifically to help lift some of the pain of sanctions placed on Russia in the aftermath of the Kremlin's aggression against Ukraine, which has caused real pain to the country's hard-hit financial sector, wrote former National Security Agency analyst and counterintelligence officer John R. Schindler in an article titled "Panama Papers Reveal Clinton's Kremlin Connection," published by The Observer on April 7, 2016. It's hardly surprising that Sberbank sought the help of Democratic insiders like the Podesta Group to aid them in this difficult hour, since they clearly understand how American politics work, he continued. The question is why the Podesta Group took Sberbank's money, Schindler asked. That financial institution isn't exactly hiding in the shadows. It's the biggest bank in Russia, and its reputation leaves a lot to be desired. Nobody acquainted with Russian finance was surprised that Sberbank wound up in the Panama Papers. Schindler noted that since the 1990s, Sberbank has grown to be Russia's dominant bank, controlling nearly 30% of Russia's aggregate banking assets and employing a quarter of a million people. The majority stockholder in Sberbank is Russia's central bank, making Sberbank functionally an arm of the Russian government, though officially, Sberbank is a private institution. Certainly Western intelligence is well acquainted with Sberbank, noting its close relationship with Vladimir Putin and his regime. Funds moving through Sberbank are regularly used to support clandestine Russian intelligence operations, while the bank uses its offices abroad as cover for the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, or SVR, Schindler pointed out. A NATO counterintelligence official explained that Sberbank, which has outposts in almost two dozen foreign countries, functions as a sort of arm of the SVR outside Russia, especially because many of its senior employees are former Russian intelligence officers. Inside the country, Sberbank has an equally cozy relationship with the Federal Security Service, FSB, Russia's powerful domestic intelligence agency. On April 17, 2014, the Moscow Times reported that Ukraine opened criminal proceedings against Sberbank and 13 other banks on suspicion of financing terrorism. Schindler noted the Ukrainian criminal investigation had concluded that Sberbank had distributed millions of dollars in illegal aid to Russian-backed separatists fighting in eastern Ukraine, with the bank serving as a witting supporter of Russian aggression against Ukraine. On April 5, 2016, Lachlan Marquet, reporting in the Washington Free Beacon, published the lobbying registration form the Podesta Group filed with the U.S. government, proving that Sberbank had contracted with the Podesta Group to advance their interests with banking, trade, and foreign relations. According to the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project produced by the Panama Papers journalist, Sberbank has ties to companies used by members of Putin's inner circle to funnel state resources into lucrative private investments. On March 30, 2016, Politico reported that the Podesta Group registered to lobby for the U.S. subsidiary of Sberbank to see if relief could be obtained for the bank in the easing of U.S. sanctions against Russia for Russia's role in the Ukraine conflict. John Podesta briefly served as Clinton Foundation CEO. According to a New York Times report published August 13, 2013, a wave of mid-level program staff members departed the Clinton Foundation in 2011, reflecting the frustration of much of the foundation's policy personnel with the old political hands running the organization. Around that time, Bruce Lindsay, then the Clinton Foundation CEO, suffered a stroke, underscoring concerns about the foundation's line of succession. John Podesta, a chief of staff in Mr. Clinton's White House, stepped in for several months as temporary chief executive. Hillary's Russia Reset and the sale of military technology to Russia. According to information recently released in the Panama Papers, John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign manager, is implicated in the Clinton Foundation's shadowy offshore money laundering operations, receiving money from Russia apparently in exchange for the transfer of U.S. advanced technology, including technology with military implications, arranged by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton as part of her Russian reset strategy with Vladimir Putin. During his 2009 visit to Moscow, President Obama announced the creation of a U.S.-Russia bilateral presidential commission, with Secretary Clinton heading the American side and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov representing the Russians. To implement this agreement, Secretary Clinton launched her Russian Reset Initiative, and Putin established the Skolkovo Innovation Center west of Moscow as an area style to be built as Russia's alternative to Silicon Valley, with the Kremlin committed to spending $5 billion over the next 3 years to fund it. To head Skolkovo, Putin appointed Viktor Vekselberg, one of Russia's wealthiest oligarchs, who had become a multi-billionaire through controlling the Renova Group, a Russian conglomerate with extensive investments in mining, oil, and natural gas, and telecommunications. The stated goal of Secretary Clinton's Russian reset policy was to identify U.S. technology transfers to Russia that would attract U.S. financiers to invest together with the Russian state investment fund Rusnano, a technology investment fund Putin created in 2007, by relying totally on Russian government funding. Dozens of U.S. tech firms, including Clinton Foundation donors like Google, Intel, and Cisco, made major financial contributions to Skolkovo, with Cisco committing $1 billion. By 2012, the vice president of the Skolkovo Foundation, Conor Lenihan, the minister of state at Irish Aid who had participated with the Clinton Foundation, contributing 70 million euros in Irish government funds to fight HIV/AIDS in Africa, reported that Skolkovo had assembled 28 Russian, American, and European key partners, 17 of whom, 60%, had made financial commitments totaling tens of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation or sponsored speeches by Bill Clinton. State Department emails revealed that 3 months after Putin appointed Vekselberg to head the Skolkovo project, a Clinton Foundation employee began pushing the State Department to approve a planned trip by Bill Clinton to Russia to meet with Vekselberg and a handful of other Russian investments. Donor records show Vekselberg's Renova Group had contributed between $50,000 and $100,000 to the Clinton Foundation, with another firm associated with Vekselberg, Osi Erlikon, donating $25,000 to the Clinton Foundation. The U.S. Army Foreign Military Studies Program at Fort Leavenworth concluded in 2012 that the purpose of Skolkovo was to serve as a vehicle for worldwide transfer to Russia in the areas of information technology, biomedicine, energy, satellite and space technology, as well as nuclear technology. Soon the U.S. government was aware that the Obama administration was approving the transfer of classified, sensitive, and emerging military technology to Russia, including approving the first weapons-related project in the development of a hypersonic cruise missile engine. A 2006 report titled From Russia with Money, released in August by the Government Accountability Institute, where Clinton Cash author Peter Schweitzer is president and Steve Bannon, a key advisor to Donald Trump's campaign and White House, was a director, charged that Secretary Clinton used the Russian Reset and the Skolkovo project to funnel U.S. military technology to Russia. Russia pays off Podesta in complex international money laundering scheme. In June and July 2011, while he was advising Clinton on State Department policy, John Podesta joined the board of three related entities: Juul Unlimited, a small Massachusetts-based energy company, its holding company Juul Global Holdings NV, which was based in the Netherlands, and Juul Global Stichting, which appears to be the ultimate controlling entity. In a complicated chain of connections familiar to those conversant with how international money laundering transactions are structured, Victor Vexelberg made a multi-million dollar investment into Juul Unlimited, the small Massachusetts-based energy company owned by Juul Global Holdings NV in the Netherlands. The investment was laundered from Rusnano to Renova in a deal that made sense to Russian financial authorities given Vexelberg's role as president of the Skolkovo Foundation. The Government Accountability Institute report from Russia with Money noted that Russia created the Juul group of companies supposedly to develop technologies aimed at harnessing solar energy. Although following international money laundering trails is a complicated process, the key point is that 2 months after Podesta joined the Juul Unlimited board, Vladimir Putin's Rusnano announced that it would invest up to $35 million in Juul Unlimited. On August 1, 2016, Bannon and Schweitzer co-authored an article in Breitbart titled, "Report, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager John Podesta sat on board of company that bagged $35 million from Putin-connected Russian government fund." Podesta, it turns out, also consulted with the Weiss Foundation, a group controlled by Swiss billionaire Hans-Jörg Weiss, an investor in Juul Energy. Podesta was paid $87,000 by the Weiss Foundation in 2013, according to federal tax records. Weiss was also a major Clinton Foundation donor, with the Weiss Foundation contributing between $1 million and $5 million. To complete the circle, Vexelberg, the Renova Group, and the Skolkovo Foundation joined Weiss in establishing ties to the Clinton Foundation, either as substantial donors or as participants in the Clinton Global Initiative. Bannon and Schweitzer further reported that Podesta's far-left think tank, Center for American Progress, CAP, took in $5.25 million from the Sea Change Foundation between 2010 and 2013. The Sea Change Foundation, it turns out, ties into various entities specifically named and investigated in the Panama Papers, including Klein Limited and Troika Dialogue Limited. Metcom Bank appears to be the bank Vexelberg has used to make transfers to the Clinton Foundation, with the money flowing from the Moscow branch of Metcom Bank to Deutsche Bank and Trust Company Americas, with the money finally ending up in a private bank account in the Bank of America in New York City that is operated by the Clinton Foundation. Here is what the Government Accountability Institute report had to say about the Sea Change Foundation. Who was funding Sea Change Foundation? According to tax records, Sea Change Foundation, at the time, was receiving a large infusion of funds from a mysterious Bermuda-based entity called Klein Limited. Who owns Klein? It is impossible to say exactly, given corporate secrecy laws in Bermuda. But the registered agent and lawyers who set up the offshore entity are tied to a handful of Russian business entities, including Troika Dialogue Limited. Leadership includes Ruben Vardanyan, an ethnic Armenian who is a mega oligarch in Putin's Russia. Vardanyan also served on the board of Juul Energy with John Podesta. Why Hillary Clinton's State Department and her campaign manager were tied up in this raises serious questions that demand answers and transparency, Bannon and Schweitzer concluded. Podesta payoff in Russian money-laundered stock options. In an email dated January 6, 2014, Mark Salakian, a senior vice president and general counsel with Juul Unlimited, emailed Podesta, confirming that Podesta had exercised 75,000 shares out of 100,000 options in Juul Unlimited that he had been issued in 2011 under stock option agreements issued to him in partial compensation for his work on the Juul Board of Directors. Salakian confirmed that Podesta had transferred the resulting 75,000 common shares of Juul Unlimited to Leonidio Holdings, LLC, in a transaction that most likely would prevent the 75,000 common shares of Juul stock from showing up directly as an asset owned in any financial statement Podesta prepared. Leonidio Holdings, LLC, is a private company listed in Salt Lake City, Utah, that was subsequently transferred to the address of Podesta's daughter, Megan Rouse, at 7962 Shannon Court in Dublin, California, where his daughter operates a financial planning company. By transferring ownership of the Juul stock to an account registered to his daughter, Podesta appears to have engaged in a process of asset structuring whose purpose may have been to hide the asset from public disclosure and or avoid certain tax consequences that may have resulted from public disclosure. What is clear from the emails released by WikiLeaks is that Podesta confirmed that he transferred 25,146 shares of Series C preferred shares and 8,547 Series C2 preferred shares of Juul Unlimited stock to Leonidio Holdings, LLC. The shares were subsequently transferred to the address of his daughter's company, Megan Rouse Financial Planning. Same Ukrainian group contracting Manafort also contracted Podesta Group. Special Counselor Robert Mueller, in his investigation into Tony Podesta, disclosed that the same Ukrainian group, the European Center for a Modern Ukraine, ECMU, that established a public relations contract with Paul Manafort, also established a similar contract with the Podesta Group. On December 20, 2013, in a disclosure largely ignored by the mainstream media as the Manafort controversy developed after the 2016 election, Reuters reported that ECMU had paid $900,000 to the Podesta Group for a two-year contract aimed at improving the image of the Yanukovych government in the United States. The Podesta Group told Reuters they were implementing this plan through contacts with key congressional Democrats. To date, the mainstream media has focused attention largely only on the contract that Manafort's K Street firm, Davis, Manafort & Friedman, established with the ECMU, not the contract established by the Podesta Group. On February 21, 2014, Russian leader Vladimir Putin helped then-President Yanukovych flee violent protests seeking to oust him from office. Yanukovych flew out of Ukraine and traveled through Crimea to arrive in Russia, where he has remained, trying desperately to restore himself to power back home in Kiev. The background of the controversy traces back to 2007, when Yanukovych's political party, Ukraine's Party of Regions, hired the ECMU to perform an extreme makeover, repositioning the party from being perceived as a haven for Donetsk-based mobsters and oligarchs into that of a legitimate political party. In Manafort's case, opponents have failed to document that Manafort ever received some $12.7 million in some 22 previously undisclosed cash payments from Yanukovych's pro-Russian party, as supposedly documented by Black Ledger entries revealed by Ukraine's National Anti-Corruption Bureau. Yet this evidence was sufficient for New York Times reporters to conclude that Manafort had hidden back-channel ties to Putin financed by under-the-table payments arranged via Ukraine. From there, the Democratic Party narrative charges that Manafort never registered as a foreign agent with the U.S. Justice Department, which would only have been required if he was contracted with the Ukrainian government, not with a political party in Ukraine, and that Manafort transferred his close relationship with Putin via Yanukovych to the Trump campaign. It turns out that the Podesta Group filed disclosures with the Justice Department, but only after the work Manafort was doing for ECMU was reported in the press. The Democratic Party narrative continues to suggest that Manafort's close relationship to the Kremlin allowed him to position the Trump campaign to receive hacked emails that embarrassed the Clinton campaign by exposing the efforts Debbie Wasserman Schultz, as chairman of the DNC, took to rig the primaries for Hillary, to the distinct disadvantage of challenger Senator Bernie Sanders. However, this entire story is thrown into disarray if the Podesta brothers, via the Podesta Group, have tighter and more easily documentable financial ties to Russia, involving far greater numbers than have ever been suggested tie Manafort to Russia via Ukraine. CNN further reported on August 19, 2016, that the Podesta Group had issued a statement upholding that the firm has retained the boutique Washington-based law firm Kaplan and Drysdale to determine if we were misled by the Center for Modern Ukraine or any other individuals with potential ties to foreign governments or political parties. The Podesta Group's statement issued to CNN continued, "When the center became a client, it certified in writing that none of the activities of the center are directly or indirectly supervised, directed, controlled, financed, or subsidized in whole or in part by a government of a foreign country or a foreign political party. We relied on that certification and advice from counsel in registering and reporting under the Lobbying Disclosure Act rather than the Foreign Agents Registration Act. The statement concluded with the following. We will take whatever measures are necessary to address the situation based on Kaplan and Drysdale's review, including possible legal action against the center. Chapter 9. Mainstream Media Attack Trump. Protesting has become a profession now. They have every right to do that, don't get me wrong, but this has become a very paid, AstroTurf-type movement. Sean Spicer, February 2017. The hard left's manipulation of the mainstream media involves more than a shared ideological worldview. Mirroring the hard left, the mainstream media favors a statist view of politics that seeks to extend massive government regulation over every aspect of life, ranging from issues debated in cultural wars to all aspects of the economy and international trade. The hard left and the deep state share a concern to expand statist control of a multinational corporate one-world government welfare state that controls people from a cradle-to-grave reality. Editors at publications including the New York Times, the Washington Post, and increasingly the Wall Street Journal have been supporters of Democratic Party socialist domestic policies, coupled with globalist international free trade agreements and unlimited open borders immigration couched as global migration patterns since at least the administration of Lyndon B. Johnson in the 1960s, and possibly as far back as the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, starting with the 1930s depression. But in recent years, seasoned hard-left political operators have stepped up their game to achieve a new goal. Aided by extensive funding from leftist millionaires and billionaires, and supplemented by the generosity of left-leaning foundations. No longer is the hard left satisfied with the mainstream media reporting a biased version of the news. Today, the hard left aims to discredit conservative and libertarian political opponents as conspiracy theorists and right-wing extremists. Sensing ultimate victory, the hard left has begun its final stage of morphing the United States into a totalitarian state that tolerates no dissent, no freedom of religion, unless belief in God is consistent with the LGBT agenda, and no deviance from the politically correct dictates of identity politics. David Brock, a conservative LGBT advocate who switched sides to the hard left, runs his Media Matters organization with a determination to silence conservative and libertarian critics across all forms of media, including radio, television, print, and now internet-based social media and blogs. The goal of groups like Media Matters today is to block conservative and libertarian reporters and pundits from mainstream media acceptance, thereby blocking public dissemination of their views. The brass-knuckle tactics Brock espouses must be taken seriously given his mean-spirited defense of his current attack dog posture. As soon as Donald Trump won the 2016 presidential election, Brock came forth to declare to his financial backers how he intended to position Media Matters to take the lead in the movement to resist and obstruct Trump's ability to rule. Brock's goal today is to weaponize the mainstream media's liberal bias by supercharging traditional public relation tactics for influencing media with Saul Alinsky-like community organizing tactics designed to provoke and ultimately win a war waged to remove conservatives and libertarians from America once and for all. David Brock's Media Matters declares war on Trump. In a briefing book titled Media Matters, the top watchdog against fake news and propaganda, transforming the media landscape, which Brock published privately in January 2017 to solicit donors for what Brock termed the Media Matters for America 2020 plan, Brock asserts his intention to declare war on Trump's ability to rule. The onslaught of well-funded right-wing media brings with it significant challenges, reads the first sentence of Brock's solicitation, picking up with Media Matters' core mission of disarming right-wing misinformation, while leading the fight against the next generation of conservative disinformation. Brock was among the first to coin conservative disinformation as fake news in the attempt to launch a meme or narrative designed to target reporters, pundits, and news media that dare publish conservative views differing from the hard left views reported uncritically by obviously left-biased cable news channels such as CNN and MSNBC. In the competitive analysis section, Brock singles out the Conservative Media Research Center for applying an $18 million annual operating budget to the goal of working closely with establishment right-wing media to reinforce the myth of a liberally biased media, push journalism to the right, and propel disinformation. Next, Brock attacks the website Breitbart for having received millions in funding from extremist billionaires close to the Trump administration, while providing a nexus point for the so-called alt-right, the newest branding for white nationalism, anti-Semitism, and misogyny, to exploit vulnerabilities through the media landscape. Note here that Brock is also creating a narrative, adding to the meme that the alt-right, another term created by Brock and the hard left to attack conservatives, are haters, characterized as white nationalists, anti-Semites, and misogynists. The new labels Brock and his co-conspirators on the hard left intend to apply, along with the accusation of being racists, to any reporter, commentator, pundit, or news agency that refuses to uncritically parrot a hard left ideological interpretation of current events. In addition, Brock leaves no doubt that Google and Facebook are his co-conspirators in advancing the fake news meme against conservative and libertarian news organizations on the internet. In the top outcomes section of the briefing book for donors, Brock lays out his goals for the coming 4 years of the Trump administration as follows. Serial misinformers and right-wing propagandists inhabiting everything from social media to the highest levels of government will be exposed. Internet and social media platforms like Google and Facebook will no longer uncritically and without consequence host and enrich fake news sites and propagandists. Toxic alt-right social media-fueled harassment campaigns that silence dissent and poison our national discourse will be punished and halted. On November 14, 2016, 6 days after Donald J. Trump was elected president, the New York Times reported that Google had announced a policy that would ban websites that peddle fake news from using its online advertising service. Hours later, Facebook updated the language in its Facebook Audience Network policy, amending it to specify that Facebook will not display ads in sites that show misleading or illegal content, to include fake news sites. On January 25, 2017, Recode.com reported that Google, since declaring the policy against fake news, had banned 200 publishers from using its AdSense network, an ad placement service that automatically places text and display ads on participating sites based on audience characteristics. Recode.com further reported that Google declined to provide a listing of the banned sites. In his briefing book, Brock acknowledged that while Google was a relatively easy sale on fake news, Facebook was a much harder sale, with Mark Zuckerberg calling crazy the notion that fake news is a problem. So what did Media Matters do? In November, we launched a campaign pressuring Facebook to 1. Acknowledge the problem of the proliferation of fake news on Facebook and its consequences for our democracy, and 2. Commit to taking action to fix the problem, the Media Matters briefing book declared. As a result of our push for accountability, Brock was happy to report Facebook was responsive to both requests. Soros muscled Glenn Beck from Fox News, Pat Buchanan from MSNBC, and Lou Dobbs from CNN. Activists like David Brock have learned from George Soros how to use economic clout to push prominent conservative and libertarian personalities off cable news, a strategy Soros began pursuing in advance of Barack Obama's 2012 re-election campaign. Among the 2,500 documents hacked from George Soros's Open Society Foundation are documents that explicitly discuss the Open Society Foundation funding various organizations to run an activist campaign aimed at ousting Glenn Beck from Fox News, Pat Buchanan from MSNBC, and Lou Dobbs from CNN. In a memorandum dated March 27, 2012, Bill Vandenberg, the head of Soros's Democracy Fund, discusses a two-year $600,000 grant to support Color of Change that was targeted to allow the organization to hold media companies accountable for derogatory actions, including successful campaigns to oust Glenn Beck from the Fox network and Pat Buchanan from MSNBC. Many documents prepared for the Open Society Foundation board described Color of Change as the largest online political activist group representing African American issues, with more than 900,000 due-paying members. Color of Change defines its mission as moving decision makers in corporations and government to create a more human and less hostile world for Black people in America. The organization boasts on its website of designing strategies powerful enough to fight racism and injustice in politics and culture, in the workplace and the economy, in criminal justice and community life, and wherever they exist. We are changing both the written and unwritten rules of society. Vandenberg confirmed what has been long suspected by conservatives and libertarians, namely that Soros has utilized his money to pay leftist advocacy groups to launch aggressive attacks on advertisers to force commentators like Beck, Buchanan, and Dobbs off cable news channels. In June 2011, when Glenn Beck was fired from his highly popular hour-long weekday show on Fox News, Huffington Post attributed the firing to an aggressive campaign that caused up to 400 advertisers to drop their support of the show, although news sources at the time failed to identify Soros as the culprit behind the organized campaign to pressure advertisers to abandon Beck on Fox. PBS host Bill Moyers later acknowledged that Beck had been fired by Fox News because Beck had refused to take the advice of senior executives to ease up on attacking Soros on air. In February 2012, Politico reported that MSNBC had finally reached a decision to sever relations with Pat Buchanan permanently after 10 years, in which time Buchanan had regularly appeared on the cable news channel. His firing was supposedly over a controversy surrounding his book, Suicide of a Superpower, Will America Survive to 2025? In a piece published in the American Conservative on February 16, 2012, titled Blacklisted But Not Beaten, Buchanan agreed that Color of Change began issuing calls for his firing almost as soon as the book was published, proclaiming that his book espouses a white supremacist ideology, pointing to Chapter 4, The End of White America, as proof of that statement. Buchanan defended the thesis of his 2012 book, arguing America is balkanizing, breaking down along the lines of religion, race, ethnicity, culture, and ideology, and that Western peoples are facing demographic death by century's end. He further commented that the modus operandi of the thought police at Color of Change is to brand any writer who dares to venture outside the narrow corral in which they seek to confine debate as racist. In a statement published on the group's website, Color of Change boasts that starting in 2009, the group forced Glenn Beck off cable television, holding his advertisers and Fox News accountable for his dangerous drumbeat of racist misinformation. Beck legitimized disproven racist ideas about the role of Black people in society by integrating them into mainstream political conversations, the posting read. White supremacists praised him for helping to make their ideas more respectable and widespread, and he did it with the support of hundreds of major corporations that advertised on his show. No one was fighting back effectively. Our movement didn't have an answer to Glenn Beck. Color of Change revealed that the decision to drive Beck off the air was made in July 2008, when Beck called President Obama a racist with a deep-seated hatred for white people. Here is how Color of Change described their economic campaign waged against Beck. Within days of Beck's attack on President Obama, tens of thousands of Color of Change members were signing our petition to all of Beck's advertisers, channeling our outrage into meaningful and strategic leverage over Fox News. At the same time, behind the scenes, our staff initiated a dialogue with some of Beck's biggest advertisers, corporations including Walmart, CVS, Best Buy, and Sprint. We conveyed to them the concerns of our members and presented them with a clear choice: stop funding Beck or become publicly associated with his racism and divisiveness. We partnered with Media Matters to track ads on Beck's show and worked with organizations including Credo Action, Move On, and Jewish Funds for Justice to draw more people into the campaign and increase the pressure. Most companies moved quickly to pull their ads once they understood the power of our members to hold them accountable. When a corporation refused, our members took action, flooding them with hundreds of phone calls and spreading content and commentary on social media that linked their brand to Beck and his attacks on black people. Nearly every corporation we targeted pulled their ads. The victories snowballed, continuing for months. More than 285,000 people signed a Color of Change petition to Beck's advertisers, demanding that Beck be removed from Fox News. In an Open Society Foundation summary of U.S. programs, USP, for the Soros-funded Democracy and Power Fund in 2011 through 2012, a chart credits that Soros's funding of various Hispanic advocacy groups was responsible for forcing CNN to cancel Lou Dobbs's hour-long television program, Lou Dobbs Tonight. The chart entry lists the Soros-funded grantees involved as 1. Citizen Engagement Lab, the parent group for the African-American advocacy group Color of Change, and the Hispanic advocacy group Presente. 2. New Organizing Institute, and 3. Voto Latino. On November 11, 2009, when Lou Dobbs made a surprise announcement that he had decided to quit CNN, Roberto Lovato, co-founder of Presente, said, "Our contention all along was that Lou Dobbs, who has a long history of spreading lies and conspiracy theories about immigrants and Latinos, does not belong on the most trusted name in news. We are thrilled that Dobbs no longer has the legitimate platform from which to incite fear and hate." When charges of sexual harassment and misconduct involving Fox News host Bill O'Reilly arose in March and April 2017, Media Matters organized a boycott of O'Reilly's sponsors while fanning the flames with mainstream media outlets. On April 1, 2017, The New York Times reported that O'Reilly and Fox News's parent company, 21st Century Fox, had paid out approximately $13 million over 2 decades to a total of 5 women who agreed not to pursue litigation or speak about their accusations against O'Reilly for sexually inappropriate conduct. On April 4, 2014, Media Matters published a list of companies that had pulled advertising from airing during the O'Reilly Factor. Media Matters reported that O'Reilly's advertising had experienced a drastic plummet overall, suggesting that the campaign to exert economic pressure on Fox News to fire O'Reilly was working. In addition to these specific moves against conservative media targets, the mainstream media, CNN, MSNBC, and the 24/7 news cycle itself, seems to be dedicated to destroying Trump and his presidency. Mainstream media's constant breaking news alerts and expert commentary focus relentlessly on criticisms of Trump's every word, yet give little time to any accomplishments or positive news coming out of the White House. The Indivisible Movement. Indivisible has risen as a hard-left grassroots partisan group dedicated to applying Tea Party tactics to resist and obstruct the Trump agenda, including targeting Trump-supporting GOP members of Congress and disrupting town hall meetings, to visiting district congressional offices to ask questions about racism, authoritarianism, and corruption. Posted on the group's website is the Indivisible Guide, described as a practical guide for resisting the Trump agenda. The authors of the Indivisible Guide claim to be former progressive congressional staffers who saw the Tea Party beat back President Obama's agenda. The guide teaches progressive activists techniques of disruption that can be applied to harass any member of the House or Senate who dares to support Trump. Consider the first paragraph in the introduction to the guide as a statement of resistance and obstruction. Donald Trump is the biggest popular vote loser in history to ever call himself president. In spite of the fact that he has no mandate, he will attempt to use his congressional majority to reshape America in his own racist, authoritarian, and corrupt image. If progressives are going to stop this, we must stand indivisibly opposed to Trump and the members of Congress, MOCs, who would do his bidding. Together, we have the power to resist, and we have the power to win.